This episode of AVXL was recorded on March 21st, 2018. We're going to talk new TVs on the shelves, streaming 4K versus UHD, Blu-rays, ELAX debut, 2.0, subwoofer decisions, Netflix Door, Dolby Vision AVR upgrades, and would you believe it? There's even more coming.
Testing 1, 2, 3. All right. I'm not blowing anything out.
Ignorant weasels chewing on your soul. Ignorant weasels. Do you have speed?
Yeah.
Welcome to AVXL, your guide to the best in home theater and audio gear, no matter what your budget is. I'm Patrick Norton.
Hello, I am Robert Herron.
And we went kind of nuts this week.
There's a lot going on.
We're
going to try to get a couple episodes banged out this week to help make up for our spotty scheduling. Random things keep popping up, man.
New studios. Brain damage to houses, flooding, mayhem.
I have new gear here and there.
Never, by the way, leave a plastic crate with a couple hundred CDs out it outside of your garage right before 2 inches of rain falls in 24 hours.
Unless you have a good sealing on that or a good seal.
Yeah, I didn't.
One of those black and yellow tubs you can get at Costco.
It turns out after you've ruined all of the paper and was inside the CD cases, CDs take up a lot less space when you get rid of that.
I really don't miss that. I did take every CD I own and took them out of jewel cases and put it into a folder. I did actually tear apart, took all the artwork with it, saved everything that was included in the disc cases themselves. And in a handful of cases, this is several hundred discs, in a handful of cases, there was like hidden artwork in the jewel case. And I was like, whoa, that would have sat on a shelf for 20 years. And unless somebody else told me it was in there, I would have never seen it. So there is some advantages to just breaking loose. But I'm now trying to think of where I put those folders of CDs. And they're probably in my storage unit somewhere.
Probably.
So, anyway.
Hopefully. Well, I've been re-ripping my entire collection,
making it perfect.
Yeah.
For me, it was all about making sure the album titles and artist folders and everything was laid out just the way I wanted it. Yeah. And even in terms of file names, do you want a number at the very beginning of the track or,
you can change that later, but it's much easier to get it right when you rip it.
Yeah. Consistency.
We had a tweet, I want to say, at AVXL, where somebody was asking about the application we use to rip CDs. And, there are lots of free applications out there, but both of us have paid the money for DB Power Amp.
Yep. DBPowerAmp.com.
Yeah. Well, it's a fantastic tool. It does batch conversions. For example, that was my original CD Monster 2000 or 3000 CD Ripper. Rip Monster, that was the name of it.
Rip Monster.
I had like six CD drives. But it has a fantastic ripping tool, a fantastic encoding tool. It'll run multiple rips and encodes simultaneously. It does a fantastic job verifying your rips, which has been an emotionally traumatic tool for me to deal with because I've discovered that some CDs I had, I now own at least three copies of Rage Against the Machine's first album because my original sort of, early 90s copies had some scratches on it, and I wanted a perfect rip because I was feeling that way. It's such an important album to me.
Like you mentioned too, the tools for doing batch conversions or ripping your discs and the features that are included with DB Power Amp. Yes, there's usually a free way to do it.
Yeah.
I just find the convenience factor of having it just literally, what codecs do you need? Mm-hmm. What do you want to do? It's all kind of built into one app.
Yeah.
And
there's no spyware. There's no bloatware. There's no ads.
I purchased it years ago and you don't get continual updates for every new version, but I can still go download that version I purchased. Still works great. Still
awesome
have access to all the codecs. Yeah. It works really well. And I want to say it was who tweeted? Matt Longnan. I hope I'm saying that right.
Yeah, I mean,
he was wondering about our app of choice for this kind
of
work.
But, I mean, the Perfect Meta, which basically pulls in all of this metadata and artwork, and Accurate Rip is a big deal for me because I was laughing, right?
Again, that's a free tool. You can find tools that support that AccuRip system for free, where it basically creates a checksum of what you ripped and then compares it to what everyone else did and to make sure that you get bit-for-bit accurate copies.
Yeah.
Things like that. So.
I'm okay with paying money to simplify my life. I'm at an age, the children, the time.
For me, it's the audio converter. Just being able to select these 600 discs and then convert that to some obscure format just, for backup purposes or for whatever.
Because we can.
And make all that album art and tag information perfect every time.
dbpoweramp.com is the website.
Yeah, that's a lifesaver of an app.
Yeah, it's and you can try the reference version free for 21 days.
Oh, cool.
They have an OS 10 version. They've got a Windows version.
Excellent.
Just so you know, it's out there. Oh, my goodness. Yeah, I literally have at least three copies that I've found so far. Because I had the original copy that was scratched of Rage Against the Machine. The second copy, which was supposed to be an early copy, they sent me a post-20th anniversary remastering version, which we don't talk about on this show because I can't talk about it without having expletives.
Just Google Sausage of Sound. Something along those lines.
We've talked about it.
I think I've had like one or two discs I've purchased repeatedly, either mostly because they were just missing, likely lifted at some point. Or it's like, oh, I like this disc too. It's going with me.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm like, where did that disc go? And it's like, okay, I'm going to buy that again.
Fiona Apple's first album, I've had that stolen from me. Not lost, assure you. Stolen from me at least five times.
I didn't see anybody steal it, but I assume that's what happened. But I really don't know. It was a chaotic period of my life.
Well, I can also tell sort
of
relationships I was in with where I can see why people would remove a title.
Why I own a storage container.
Oh, my goodness. That isn't even the thing we were crazy about this week, right?
No.
Because I had a viewer question on tech thing asking, like, is the three... It was funny. The question was $2, but as of April 16th, I think it's going to be $3 extra to go from the HD version of Netflix to the UHD version of Netflix.
Oh, I pay the max. I pay $14 a month right now for the four simultaneous feeds in 4K.
And that's what you get, right?
You have to do it that way to get the full.
Well, I think they decided to make it a little, you know, we'll make it, you know, what bonus can we give people when they pay the extra $3 a month for the 4K UHD streaming quality?
I have a couple of friends who love me.
And you get, you can stream in four screens simultaneously in HD or UHD, and you can download to four, you know, iOS, Android, or Windows devices. And, you know, store the, for what titles are actually available.
I mean, I have three devices in my lab right now that connected to one TV, including the built-in app that all support Netflix. So I don't want to deal with, you know, oh, I got to disassociate this device and then associate this device or however it works.
Right.
This just works every time and it works great.
And it was interesting because part of what I started looking at in answering this guy's question was, you know, what bit rate do they stream at? You know, what does it take to actually connect to them? What's the quality? And I also realized, you know, because when I first was searching for UHD Blu-ray titles, and I'm talking about Blu-ray titles now that are 4K UHD, it looked like there were like 327 on Best Buy. Then I realized like a third of those are alternate versions or exclusives or bundled with a t-shirt or those stupid canned ones that irritate me so much.
On Netflix, I did fire up the hidden data menu that you can enable on probably most clients, including my new Roku Ultra. And I was just looking at the related bitrate for various 4K ultra high def titles in addition to the HDR titles that, at least as far as I can tell, those are labeled separately for a reason, your HDR stuff being your wide color gamut plus high dynamic range in addition to 4K resolution. And then the stuff labeled 4K ultra high def or whatever they say, or 4K. Yeah, I think it just says that. That's, I believe, just strictly a 4K resolution stream.
Right.
And both of those sources, at least on my crazy internet connection here, were delivering, at least to me, and according to the reporting of the Roku app, version of Netflix, 15.26 megabits.
15.26.
It never went above it. And I have 100 or 200 megabit coming into this house.
Right.
And on services like YouTube that also feature, I think, a nerd details setting or nerd stats that I absolutely love, it was showing with that service, I had like a 60 megabit connection to their service. And, it, you know, granted, it's not streaming anywhere close to that, but that was the link to them. So I have no problem pulling in 15, 25 megabit from a service, but I'm not seeing any streaming. I'd be curious if any other 4K UHD streaming services are breaking that 15 megabit
I'm
level.
I'm glad you asked, because originally Amazon said they were going to ask for 15 megabits, and then they upped that to 25 megabits. And I liked your theory on that, which is if you can stream 25, you can probably stream 15 with no problem, and we'll have fewer tech support calls.
That is got to be it, because you think about other people in your household. It's assuming you only, as a single user, you have access to all that bandwidth, right. But you might be in a household. Who knows? So, who knows what your actual network streaming performance right. is?
Apple also asked for 25 megabits.
Okay.
Amazon is asking for 15 megabits, and Vudu says they start at 11 megabits. Ooh. But the other thing that's interesting about Vudu, when you search for 4K titles on Vudu, you don't just get 4K titles, but you get 4K titles and HDX titles, which are their 60 frames per second 1080p Ooh. Video that only shows up on Vudu or only gets called out on
Vudu. I love my Vudu.
But when you start looking at this, my first thought is if you're not a big fan of Netflix original series, the value of Netflix 4K is considerably less, because when you scroll down in, a page, like there's I want to say Narcos is on there and Masters of None and Marvel's The Defenders and my least favorite Marvel thing ever, Marvel's Iron Fist, Jessica Jones, Marco Polo, which we spent a lot of time watching in 4K last year, Grace and Frankie, which is a great show. There's a ton of Netflix titles, Netflix series, and a ton of Netflix original films.
Categorized under 4K,
yeah.
Which includes that mix of the HDR yeah. and the 4K resolution content. And my quick and dirty just look through what I had available on the app on at least through the Roku, mm-hmm. I was seeing at least 75, 80 titles.
Yeah.
And that probably wasn't a complete list. That was just me literally clicking through. Here's the 4K category and just start scrolling left and right until I, looped through yeah. it.
Well, here's the thing, though. When you finally get to non-Netflix titles that aren't series, that aren't Netflix movies, that aren't Netflix comedy and specials, you get like 25 titles. You get Better Call Saul, seasons 1 and 2. You get Breaking Bad, 1 through
AMC?
5. Planet Earth 2, The Blacklist, Video Game High School, and then, Badasses on the Bayou, Diary of an Exorcist, Zero, Fireplace 4K, the classic crackling fireplace, which is a must-have
it really
during
is sweet.
The holiday season. Groundhog Day.
Wow. Okay.
Moving Art Ocean. Well, Groundhog Day I love.
Oh, no. Bill I think Murray. That's awesome.
Moving Art Oceans, Moving Art Underwater, Moving Art Waterfalls, Samurai Gourmet, She's Gotta Have It, another classic title, Talladega Nights, True to the Game, The Da Vinci Code, The Holiday, and that's it.
Yeah, it's pretty scattergun in terms yeah. of especially older content. But everything as far as Netflix original content goes nowadays yeah. is all 4K.
Yes.
And glorious audio quality.
So if you're looking for feature movies, if you don't care about Netflix series or Netflix content, for me, it's like it's $3 a month, right? It's two cups of – well, actually now a cup of coffee, a cup of drip coffee at Starbucks is $2.50. So for slightly more than the cost of a single cup of coffee or a mediocre beer, not that I drink.
Or you think
– you get – all the 4K content on Netflix.
For four simultaneous streams within a single household, $15 or $14 a yeah. month is nothing compared yeah. to even one trip to the movie theater
yeah.
or something like that. So granted,
that makes sense to me.
There are some amazing experiences in your local cinema. But
if you want 4K UHD feature movies, though, you need to go to Vudu, you need to go to Amazon Prime, you need to go to iTunes. And what was kind of crazy for me was realizing you get a highly compressed 4K movie for like 2/3 of the price of buying the Blu-ray, the UHD Blu-ray. And the UHD Blu-ray, they can, is 4K on Netflix compressed? Absolutely.
Oh, everything. All video is compressed.
Yeah.
Everything we see from any source is compressed.
Yeah, but the difference between compressed on a UHD Blu-ray, where it can stream up to, if it's a 100 gigabyte triple layer Blu-ray, it can stream at a max of 128 megabits per second. Let's say it's only streaming at 50 megabits per second.
Fire hose.
That's still more than, even if it's only streaming from a Blu-ray at 50 megabits per second, that's still in excess of three times the bandwidth that's being allotted by Netflix.
Totally.
Or any of the other services based on...
And you consider that even 1080p regular Blu-ray mm-hmm. was streaming in excess of 40 megabits or faster in many cases. So that was always something worth noting. And with the new UHD formats, not only are they using improved compression standards, but there is a doubling or tripling in some cases, depending on the disk size, mm-hmm. of how much data per second can be used to generate that picture you see. Yeah. And that ties right into the quality you see, especially on the larger size screens where you can really perceive it. Where I notice it the most, dark scenes. Dark scenes are harder to compress than scenes that are extremely well lit or outdoor daylight scenes. You will see more blockiness in shadows in dark scenes on a compressed source than you will otherwise. In addition to that,
scene, full screen explosions.
Yes. Yeah. Where the whole scene, or in a, where they have a scene where somebody's getting their picture taken with a flash and the whole scene or the whole screen in one frame is changing every pixel. That's where the compression can just break down and it becomes like a blocky mess. And those are things I don't believe I've ever seen in Blu-ray. I'm sure there's some bad examples, be it, you know, 1080p Blu-ray or 4K UHD Blu-ray.
I mean, I still remember, you know, back when 1080p streaming over satellite was such a novel thing.
It was beautiful.
It was beautiful. It was beautiful until you got to...
very similar to streaming.
Yeah. Well, I mean, my worst compression experience since like the early days of people attaching videos on AOL.
I miss
that. Remember AOL videos?
I do. Actually, I have an aunt, I think, who still has an AOL email address.
But there's kind of the closing scenes in Speed Racer, the movie. By the time it got through the satellite, these scenes with the Mach 5 and the other cars racing, it looked like 8-bit video from a, you know, from a stand-up console in the late 80s. so, you know.
Compression breaks down, even with the best streaming available today. Yeah. So, and is it night and day for a lot of people? You know, it depends. How is your eyesight? How good is your equipment set up?
Do you
is
pay
it set
attention?
Up properly? Yeah. It doesn't even matter for some people.
I mean, a crappy VHS of Citizen Kane is still the story of Citizen Kane and most of the visual quality there.
Yep.
You know, DVDs of you know, I mean, not that there is a, I guess there is a DVD of Guardian of the Galaxy, but you know, would I rather watch Guardians of the Galaxy, you know, in 4K where I can admire the extraordinary, you know, CG that goes into Rocket's fur? Absolutely. Is it still pretty good streaming? Absolutely. Do I watch it on Blu-ray rather than streaming? Yes.
Whenever
because
possible.
I'm that kind of guy.
The convenience of streaming cannot, that is what it is.
Yeah.
And the quality, I am honestly kind of surprised in this day and age that we can actually do decent looking streaming of 4K content with high dynamic range, with great audio.
That's H.265. That's VP9.
Yeah. It will only get better, but it is all to be compared to what we're already doing with Blu-ray. And, and you know, some people are done with discs, and I fully understand that. However, if you truly want that great experience,
get a disc.
Including lossless audio formats, be it DTS HD, Dolby True HD, or Atmos. You still need to do that over HDMI to get the full effect.
If you want Atmos, I mean, they are starting to encode titles in Atmos. They're doing it on Vudu. They're doing it at Netflix.
But that does get downsampled a little bit. It's not the full bitrate for most streaming sources. And coming out of, if you're doing like ARC support out of a TV that has it built in and it's able to provide that Dolby Atmos stream, it's often downsampled at least to Dolby Digital Plus, which still contains a great sounding Atmos experience, but is it identical to what you'd get off of, say, an ultra high def Blu-ray? And it's probably not. Again, depending on your gear, the convenience level, you know.
I have nothing against convenience, but I often am surprised by how delighted I am at the improvement of the experience when I'm watching a Blu-ray. But then again, you know, I'm a guy that still has like 900 CDs. Some of which I left out in the rain.
I was watching on Netflix some Planet Earth 2, and I kept feeling that the scenes were just a little soft overall, and that encouraged me to go grab an ultra high def Blu-ray player and hook it up and drop the discs in. And I am going to do some further. I need to do some scene matching between the streaming source versus the player itself and see if I can get some good A/B. But generally speaking, there's really no comparison, but it goes back to, you know, your level of comfort and what it is you're trying to do. But don't discount the Blu-ray. Yeah, I know everyone says discs are dead and things like that.
Yeah,
but
they're not.
No, not even.
For us. There's just not as many of those titles. Because I think there's about 191 sort of feature movies on UHD Blu-ray. So.
Oh, nice.
But given that they started, you know, kind of shipping about a year ago, that's actually not a bad number. Speaking of things we're excited about, ELAC's debut 2.0. I did not expect them to rev the debut line in, you know, basically like 3 years, right? ELAC came out with, you know, Andrew Jones and co left Pioneer. They went
keeping
to ELAC.
It fresh.
Yeah, and they launched with the debut, which is a fantastic set of speakers, bookshelf speakers or floor standing speakers. They came out with the Unify the next year, which I own. I paid cash out of pocket. If you're not going to spend $1,500 or more, that is the speaker to buy as far as I'm concerned.
Good to know.
Dante came out last year. They came out with the sort of taller, thinner, you know, piano quality finish updates to the Unify speakers.
Piano Black is like I never want to deal with Piano Black anything ever again, from dust and fingerprints alone, scratches.
And you don't even have kids in this house.
Oh, no. Oh. I still have. I remember one installation I think we were both a part of where a beautiful set of speakers, who made them? I forget. A B&W, mm-hmm. Bowers & Wilkins.
Yeah.
First thing the kid did was walk up to this beautifully aluminum-domed tweeter and just push that dome right in and crinkle it. And it, you want to hear just a muted howl from the owner going, what just happened? Would they replace this, please? It's like, well, we'll see.
Well, they'll replace it. I mean, well, that's one of the nice things is there are replacement parts available from BMW.
Yeah.
They just but might be terrifying in what they cost.
I'm not bagging on kids either. You know, we were all there at one point.
I know, but I remember.
And I'm still alive, so I thank whoever had to bring me up. And you know, I'm still here.
I took apart my father's pocket watch he got from his grandfather.
Oh,
the fact that I wasn't buried somewhere in the state of Iowa after that stunt is a testament to my father's love for me. But let us talk about our love for ELAC speakers,
yes.
Right? Big changes actually to this speaker. You know, new drivers, new waveguides, cabinets, and networks. By networks, I mean the crossover. You know, still a silk dome tweeter. They set it up so it has a wider dispersion, right? They push it sort of forward in the enclosure, closer to the face. They changed the waveguide on that. Goes lower than the previous tweeter, so they changed the crossover.
Nice.
This is a two speaker. There are two drivers in this speaker.
Gotcha.
So they made a considerably lower point on the crossover between the woofer and the tweeter. The tweeter now goes up to around 35,000 hertz. You know, so by moving the tweeter forward in the enclosure, the dispersion is wider, so you can basically, you know.
The sweet
you don't
spot
have to tow them
bigger.
In. Yeah, you don't have to tow them in to be in the middle of the sweet spot. And because they were able to lower the frequency on the tweeter by so much, or extend the low frequency on the tweeter by so much, it should be more tightly integrated with the woofer. You know, there's just not enough coffee.
For woofer, woofer.
Yeah, so a new woofer design. They improved the stiffness, the damping. You know, the MDF
enclosure. All the
things
you want.
Yeah, well, and the enclosure is stiffer now, in part because they put an internal brace on that. So, you know, when you knock on a cabinet, the drivers create sound. The sound rattles around inside the cabinet. The cabinet basically radiates sound from the enclosure itself, which creates issues. By putting an internal brace on that and making the design stiffer, they reduce the vibrations on the cabinet, which improves the sound.
Very cool.
Not
are they
crazy
are they,
bracing, but I think well placed.
Are they jacking the prices up?
Oddly enough, no. But wait, let's talk about some more of the design changes.
Oh, okay.
The speaker is now kind of taller and skinnier. They move the bass pores to the front of the cabinet below the woofer.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so you can, you know, you can, I'm going to quote ELAC, so that this is not attributed to me. Moving the bass port to the front of the cabinet means placement against walls or in bookshelves won't compromise performance. Now, we all know, like, we want our speakers out from the wall and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, I'm sure there are spousal acceptance factors out there where people would love to be able to shove the speaker closer to the wall. And this gives you an opportunity to do that.
Increasing placement flexibility.
Big changes to the center channel, which I won't get into. You know, the MSRP on this is like $20 more than the original.
That's fine.
So
sounds like they massaged a good design into something even better.
Yeah.
And being able to improve things like high frequency dispersion, mm-hmm. making that high frequency sweet spot a little wider, that helps a lot.
I'm pretty excited about that. We hopefully will have a set in of those in the next few days to listen to. But, you know, this is a pretty serious redesign for a pretty beloved speaker. I'm very interested to hear because they feel like they've really designed a center channel that is you know, not just like, how do we make the left and right speaker flat?
Right.
You know, so it'll fit under the TV. You know, they've got the Atmos add-on speakers. They've got a new subwoofer to go with this. They've got floor standers. It's a pretty complete upgrade, right? So, you know, 5 1/4 inch two-way bookshelf speakers, 6 1/2 inch two-way bookshelf speakers, you know, 5 1/4 and 6 1/2 inch center speakers, 5 1/4 and 6 1/2 inch three-way floor standing speakers where they've got like two woofers and a tweeter, you know, Dolby Atmos speakers, some new two-way 4 inch on-wall speakers.
Oh, nice.
Surround speakers. And then you use the app on your phone to EQ the subwoofer. And now they've got a 10 inch 400 watt powered subwoofer. You're starting at like $250 for the 5 1/4 inch bookshelf speakers, $300 for the 6 1/2 inch bookshelf speakers. Apparently they're in Magnolia stores and they're going to be sold in all the familiar channels from the ELAC products.
I have a Magnolia nearby. Yeah. And you have to go take a peek.
So I'm excited for ELAC. So hopefully we're going to hear those in the next week or two and get your response on that. It'll be fun to talk about those. Shit dropped a couple of new products in advance of CanJam Singapore.
Ooh.
CanJam LA is coming in the first week of April. I'm going to try to convince Robert to join me at CanJam this year just to watch his tongue fall out of his face if I can get him down there.
I like going to LA. I would like to go to Singapore.
I would like to go to lots of places, but I'm still married, in part because I haven't gone to Singapore. But
passport ready.
Oh, my goodness. You know, Shit introduced the Lear 3. It's the third generation of the Lear headphone amp and preamp, which is, amongst other things, including an AK4490 DAC, where you can also do a phono preamp inside of that. They're doing a multi-bit upgrade for that. And someday I will figure out a way to explain multi-bit DACs, but today is not that day.
They also added
a multi-bit DAC upgrade to the new Jotunheim multi-bit, which is something I am going to be planting my ears in front of and listening to intensely.
Is that a vacuum tube on the Lear 3?
That is a vacuum tube on the Lear 3.
Sticking out the top?
I am not.
So retro, baby.
Well, you know.
It probably softens and, I don't know, warms up that sound quite nicely.
Yes.
It looks cool.
It looks cool.
And I love their products.
People love, the value they're delivering. I mean, I've probably said it 30 times on this show, so why not say 31? You know, if you want to experiment with upgrading your headphones, the Shit Fulla 2 and the AudioQuest Dragonfly Black, like for $100, you know, the Shit Fulla 2 is less portable and it's got a knob on it if you love volume knobs. And I got to say, I love volume knobs because I can never quite get my iPhone, it's always just a little too high or a little too soft because there's just not enough sort of detente in the iPhone settings. But Shit's Fulla 2 and AudioQuest Dragonfly are a fantastic way to upgrade your headphones.
I want the Fulla for my desktop workstation. That's on my short list.
For your desktop workstation.
That's exactly what I need.
Oh, my goodness. In any case, a ton of good products coming out. And the 2018 TVs we've been talking about since CES are showing up in retail.
Yeah, we talked about them last week about what was coming. And lo and behold, this week, there is stuff online and in stores you can buy right now if you're just itching to look at some of the new 2018 gear, including those Samsung QLED televisions. The Q7F seems to be where they're starting off, not the premium Q8 or Q9. But available in 55, 65, and 75-inch screen sizes, available right this very minute. And what caught my eye was the NU8000 series, something we haven't talked about yet, but this will be a replacement for the MU that was pretty popular last year in the value space. And this will be available in screen sizes from 49 to 82 inches. And that 82-inch display is available right now for under $4,000. So, and that's likely the list price. So if you're looking for a decent edge-lit backlit system, that NU8000 should be pretty good. I mean, it's going to have terrific color. It probably won't reach the saturation levels of the quantum dot-based Q series or the QLED series, but this is using LED technology with enhancements to further its color reproduction.
It's probably also going to cost a lot less.
Exactly. Well, these are definitely out of the QLED series that are using the metallized quantum dots for improved color and brightness performance. So it's a little bit of a trade-off. But if you're looking for that super-sized screen that supports HDR, 4K, good streaming, easy setup, and a lot of other quality features. I think that price point is going to attract a lot of people for the largest of large screen sizes out there. And I've already seen that Q9F in the hands of some reviewers out there already who seem to have gotten a sneak peek and early access to that panel that features full array local dimming. And initially, I'm seeing nit measurements in the, I want to say, under 2,000 nits, but that was preliminary. We'll see.
Right. What's the pricing on that one going to be?
For which one? The Q9?
Yeah, the Q9 and then the entry-level one.
Q9 is going to be pretty pricey. It will be, I think, equivalent in terms of OLED premium pricing. Mm-hmm. As far as that NU 8000 series, the 49-inch lists for $1,000 right now, 55 for $1,200, 65 for $1,700, and the 75-inch is still TBD. The 82-inch is currently sitting at a hair under 4,000. So these are out right now. They haven't even received even the most basic of discounts yet. I'm mostly curious about their Q9F in particular, just to see how close that comes to OLED performance with, say, almost four times the light output. That should be impressive. The 2018 LG OLEDs, I am also seeing those panels in reviewer hands at this point. That Alpha 9 processor that'll be featured in the C series on up, pretty much every OLED this year but the B series, it's doing things that Sony tried last year and incorporated video processing features they incorporated last year with their A1E, but they're doing it better. And I'm sure Sony is going to step it up too for 2018 as well with their new OLEDs. In particular, black frame insertion that is less flickery than the 2017 Sony's, but we'll see what Sony's going to do. So this is a way to improve motion resolution at the expense of some light output, but it also requires no fancy video processing or video smoothing to produce that enhanced resolution, motion resolution. So that is something a lot of people who really appreciated the look of plasma TVs and how they dealt with motion so well. This brings OLEDs closer and closer to that mythical 4K plasma experience with, of course, much more light output. Also, in terms of video processing, banding minimization, something Sony's 2017 OLED did very well in terms of taking content that would have contouring artifacts or posterization, they call it, mm-hmm. Being able to video process that into something that doesn't look banded, especially when you're dealing with streaming content or other lesser quality sources. This will be a way to then make them look as good as possible as you're scaling them up to 4K and beyond. And a four-stage noise reduction feature, helpful for those overly compressed streams, and, of course, when you're upscaling that lower resolution again.
Interesting.
The 2017 B7A that's been out and about is now under $1,500 again, and that's the lowest price at least I've seen on Amazon. That, to me, is damn tempting, considering...
That's a lot of amazing OLED quality
I've spent much money. Back in the day, I've spent so much more for so much less.
Consistently.
This, on the other hand, I think at that price point, this is the 55-inch panel. The 65-inch is definitely going to cost more, but that B7A at under $1,500, it might be something I just simply have to add to the stable just to have it around. I'm sure I'll find good use for it as well. For Sony, their 2018 TVs are starting to appear in the usual retail places. Mm-hmm. The X850F and the X900F, they are claiming some local dimming capabilities. We'll see on that. More importantly, I was pleased to note that the long-touted firmware update for Dolby Vision support for the premium 2017 Sony TVs has finally landed. Now, apparently, this is a version of Dolby Vision support referred to as low latency, and the TV's internal apps won't be a problem. That's a simple software update that can be pushed probably along with this firmware. However, Dolby Vision outputting devices like your Apple Blu-ray players, Apple TV 4K, and so on, those are going to require updates in order to support this properly. And it is not plug and play like native Dolby Vision TVs are, like LG's TVs, in addition to, say, the Vizio series. So I am curious to see if this low latency version of Dolby Vision support built into these TVs, likely a software-based update or processing, I'm curious to see if that requires anything different in terms of calibration going down the road, because LG makes it pretty straightforward to calibrate their DV TVs, Dolby Vision TVs, and make that look fantastic, man. And I'm just curious of what the differences are in terms of outputting to this quote-unquote low-latency version of Dolby Vision that some TVs are starting to incorporate. So that is there, and it's looking good. And I'm just a big fan of Sony's TVs in general. For LCD technology, they've been one of my favorites. I'm probably not the biggest fan of Google TV or Android TV that is the basis for the back end on these systems. Right. Only because everyone I know with one eventually complains about how sluggish it becomes. You push a button and it takes like a second or two to get a response. Those kind of daily usability issues to me are just beyond annoying. And I'm hoping the 2018s really kick it up and further optimize that experience so they're not quite as laggy. You compare that to, like, be it LG's WebOS or even Samsung's Tizen-based system. They seem to degrade more gracefully over time, and you're not left, like, a year later with a TV where the built-in functionality or even just going through menus can be just a lagged experience. Annoying. Annoying to no end.
Television operating systems are dead to me. They just really are. I'm sorry.
It's so convenient, though. I mean, you consider how many ways you have to watch Dolby Vision content in particular.
I already own a Roku and an Apple TV that'll outperform them consistently.
I don't believe my Roku Ultra supports Dolby Vision. I need to verify that, but I'm pretty sure it doesn't. Yeah. Complaints.
Fernando's journey to 4K. Fernando writes, let me start by saying I am thrilled that I did the upgrade. Who was not so thrilled was the missus. She loved her Panasonic 60-inch VT60. It was our third Panasonic plasma. I previously had a 42 and 50-inch. I sold it on Craigslist and got more than I expected for it, confirming to my wife that she was right, LOL. But what prompted me to upgrade? It was Apple. When they announced that my collection will be upgraded to 4K, that was enough for me, but my upgrade did not occur then. It took a lot of prodding to convince my wife, not to mention the prices were still high. She finally broke down and let me buy one last month, and I am now a proud owner of an LG C7P 65-inch OLED. I got a great deal and took the day off, of course, to set it up. All was not peaches and cream, however, but the AVS forum came to the rescue without professional calibration. With a little tweaking of my own, it looks great. The biggest letdown, of course, is cable TV, Fios. Not that it is horrible, and the LG does a pretty good job at upscaling, just that I could tell the 1080p plasma looked better. Live TV looks the best. My biggest issue with going 4K is the HDR war, not to mention the opening of the floodgates to want to upgrade everything, which I mostly did, of course. I got the Apple TV 4K, as well as an LG UP970 UHD player that I got a great deal on. The 970 recently got the Dolby Vision update, so everything supports Dolby Vision but my Yamaha AVR. I own the RX-A1050, and it is not getting the firmware update because they claim the hardware is not supported. It actually does, and there's an online petition that unfortunately does not have enough signatures. I even wrote Yamaha to no avail. So my question is it worth replacing my 2-year-old AVR just to get Dolby Vision? I personally prefer to have all my devices routed through the AVR, despite the LG having enough inputs. Am I really missing out on a lot HDR-wise? What say you? Thanks again for your attention to this email, and oh yeah, I love the podcast and still miss HD Nation. Enviado de mi iPhone, which means sent from my iPhone, Fernando in the Bronx, New York.
I was looking at that going, what does that mean? And I'm like, oh.
Sent from my iPhone.
iPhone. iFruta.
iPhone.
That's awesome. And man, I'm telling you, those VT60s or that last generation of Panasonic's plasma tech, everyone I know who still has one still cherishes it. And it's still a great TV. And yes, the issue with AVRs right now, if you have one that's a couple of years old, is it probably won't receive a Dolby Vision update, except for maybe a couple of select models.
So you're not going to be able to pass through Dolby Vision on that?
Apparently not. And looking at the latest and greatest, or even stuff starting last year in 2017, all the major players seem to be incorporating Dolby Vision support. Denon, Marantz, Onkyo, Pioneer, Integra, Sony, Yamaha. Mm-hmm. So Fernando did the right thing. He checked for a firmware update that would add that DV support. It's clearly not going to be there. Before upgrading to something that is Dolby Vision supporting, consider over-the-air broadcasts. And with ATSC 3 coming later this year, if I'm going to get Dolby Vision built into my AVR, I'd want to make sure there's an upgrade path for HLG.
Right.
On the chance that by the end of this year, we'll have some set-top boxes outputting that format that you could take advantage of for live TV or even DVRing that kind of content. Now, ideally, I would just suggest an HDMI switch that's, you know, HDCP 2.2 and HDMI 2.0X or whatever it's going to be with audio extraction built in. But I am seeing none that actually feature uncompressed audio output via HDMI. Usually it's just optical, coaxial, and analog output. And if DTS HD Master Audio, your Dolby True HD, and Atmos, the hardcore lossless formats aren't critical to your listening experience, then that kind of a switch would allow you to at least plug right. everything into that, run an optical cable over to your AVR, and then still enjoy that content in full HDR quality while still taking advantage of your AVR in terms of it just taking the audio and distributing that how you need it. Now, adding another piece to your setup, it could cause some control issues, and that's where I think something like a universal remote would make that very much more doable. But my question is, has anyone actually seen an HDMI switch that supports HDR and 4K and all that good stuff with audio extraction output via a separate HDMI output? Much like a lot of the premium ultra-high-def Blu-ray players offer two HDMI ports on the back, output ports, right. one for the audio stream separate to the AVR, and then one for the video stream in full quality to your wonderful display. So I haven't seen anything like that. I don't know if they exist. I kind of doubt it. But if one is out there, please shoot me an email, ask@avxl.com, or on Twitter, or however. If you have an AVR from last year, the short answer is you can probably update it. It seems like all the new AVRs coming will have Dolby Vision support. My question is, where is HLG in that mix? Even though it's not critical now, but I figure if you don't want to be dealing with this question again at the end of the year, or it's also going to depend too in terms of the broadcasters and what they do with that HLG signal. If you already have a set-top box from your cable or satellite provider or whoever, Fios, will they take an HLG 4K program
right.
and convert that into some other more widely supported format like HDR10? I don't know. We'll see. I can't wait, actually. I can't wait to experience all of this, including over the air.
Yeah, so, no, and the whole...
For me, Dolby Vision's more important than HLG, but it's right. simply because of the content that's available right now.
Well, it would suck to buy a new AVR and then in 12 months be like, oh, I need a new AVR to support HLG.
I want to watch baseball in 4K with HDR. Oh, wait, no, I can't. Damn.
Oh, my
so anyway, that's a basic question, but yeah, Fernando, you're doing everything right.
Yeah, and I would, you know what, I route everything through the LG for now, or what you need to route through the LG
yeah.
for now.
It's tough to give up good audio. Yeah, I love AVRs for being the ultimate switch in terms of your audio and video support.
Well, the other thing is, I mean, you can look at what things actually support Dolby Vision and run those through the TV. It's and then you just
yeah, crawl behind there, everything. Change your cables out, or just leave a couple extra cables plugged in, and you'll no. figure it out.
No,
it's terrible.
Oh my goodness, got a subwoofer question, and this one's kind of fun. Tom wrote in, Robert and Patrick, love the show, but it cost me a ton more than my Patreon donation. If you don't know what that is, patreon.com/AVXL, that's where you can contribute a little bit monthly to help keep the show going and to pay us for our time. We appreciate that. Listening to the episode 70 talk about subwoofers and hearing you're going to have Brett Butterworth on the show, I decided to drop you a line, which reminds me, I got to email Brent. I upgraded my two-channel living room system by replacing my 21-year-old Infinity Kappa 8.1 speakers with a pair of Focal Aria 926s. Nice. I convinced my wife that we need to move my home theater SVS SB13 Plus subwoofer downstairs to supplement the bass, so I have the go-ahead to get two subs for the home theater. I think I've narrowed it down to these three subs. The $1,165 per pair Shoe Research 12-inch VTF 2 Mark V's, the $1,735 per pair 15-inch VTF 3 Mark V's, and the new $1,500 per pair Monoprice 12-inch THX Ultra. My theater is about 2,500 cubic feet. I was leaning towards the new Monoprice 12-inch THX Ultra because of its low distortion, but Brent's review of it has me thinking. Shoe subs have been around for a long time and get good reviews. Would two VTF Mark IIs in my room be overkill? The subs will be used with a 7.1 surround system with a Purion Versus speakers being driven by my new Outlaw Audio Model 5000 and Onkyo 809 for the rear surround. Also, a few years ago, I isolated my SVS subwoofer from my floor with RLX Subdued. It significantly reduced the bass impact but did a good job cleaning up the sound. How come we don't hear more about isolating speakers?
Heck yeah.
Oh my goodness.
I don't think adding two of any sub to a particular setup is a bad thing.
Right.
It's not as if you're driving them both at the same output level you would have just one.
Right.
You're splitting that load.
Well, the point of multiple subwoofers is not to be like, we are going to have more bass until your skull is crushed. It is to do things like, you know, eliminate or avoid or null out standing waves.
Yes, that's one good use.
To better, it's not so much about putting, you're not doubling the amount of dBs you're slamming the room with. You're trying to fill.
You should.
Yeah. Well, the point is to give you better bass or higher quality bass in the room, not to just make the bass louder. Although you can turn everything up to 11.
Yes.
And you know, crush your rib cage around your spine. You know, I'll be honest with you. I own a, I don't know, $15, $18 Shoe VTF2. Which still
ain't nothing wrong with that.
Which still has better specs, yeah, than a lot of subwoofers that are being sold today. Talking about Aurelux Subdude, right? So Aurelux makes room treatments, and they make what amounts to foam padding to isolate speakers from, for example, a mixing desk, right? Because you don't want your speaker, you know, your speak. It's
one thing for the sub to rumble. It's another thing for what the sub is sitting on to be rumbling as well in a way that's relatively uncontrollable.
Yeah. So, you know, Subdude or the Subdude 2 is essentially, you know, Aurelux calls it an isolation platform. So the idea is that you're decoupling the subwoofer from the surface it is sitting on, i.e. your floor. I do not believe this is snake oil. There are some people who will say it is snake oil. I always believe it is probably a good thing to, you know, kind of have the speaker do its thing.
With any setup,
yeah,
for almost any speaker, I'll run the low frequency sweeps through it just to see what rattles in the room,
yeah,
if anything. And if a simple pad under a speaker can help minimize that rather than, oh, there's something in the wall rattling that you can't easily get at.
And you literally, right, you want the sound coming from, ideally, the driver on the speaker,
right,
not from the driver on the speaker shaking the enclosure, which is shaking the floor, causing the floor to transmit audio, because it's really hard to tune a floor. It's a lot easier to tune a subwoofer. So I think, you know, most people don't think about it outside of, for the same reason most people don't think about room treatments, period, because most people think, well, I'm going to get my speakers and I put my speakers in my room and I'm done. And it's like, well, that may be true, but, you know, if I clap my hands in here,
it's a little echoey, a little.
But it's not bad, right? Because there is a big giant couch in the room, and because there are window coverings that act as diffusion, and there is a bunch of stuff on the walls that diffuses that, you don't have a big slapback echo from hell filled room.
Telling you, a stiff, flat walled room is
there.
Yes. I was just in an audio mastering suite over the last week, and no two walls in this room were parallel. And the walls themselves were actually of different geometry. So it's like they went to, that's pretty extreme, granted, but basic.
That is ideal.
Yep, for professional setup and listening, that was what you want. And
you know, so you know, there is stuff that people take for granted when they are setting up mastering rooms or studios that is certainly done at the high end of audio and home theater, but is rarely considered for the consumer. So yeah, you know, if you're realizing that your extreme case, if you're realizing that your subwoofer seems to be spending most of its energy vibrating the floor rather than moving, you know, the diaphragm in and out, then I would definitely start looking at stuff like isolation. Circling back to Shoe and Monoprice, Monoprice has done some great products.
I do want to read this Brent review though, because what did he say that has Tom thinking?
Well, it's very, very tall.
I'm going to take a read on that.
Yeah. You know, what it comes down to, right, is when you look at this, usually Monoprice is making products that are competing at a particularly low price compared to what else is out there. And when you look at Brent's work for the Wirecutter, where they pick the kind of the best subwoofer for most people, they pick a Monoprice subwoofer that is a fantastic deal.
The $100
deal.
One.
Yeah.
This is more of like $700 per speaker.
Yeah.
So, or per sub.
And his thought for this speaker was it was particularly tight. It was very tight, controlled bass, more so than he expected. And so the music performance was outstanding. And then he fired up U571. And I'm going to quote Brent from soundstageaccess.com. We'll put a link in the show notes. Quote, I love to test subs with this film. no pun intended, I'm sure, because it contains such a wide variety of base tests, including depth charges, ship engine rumble, and cannon fire. You know, and he said the Monolith THX Ultra again sets the THX EQ mode with two ports open, nailed all three. So it's if you haven't seen U571 and you got a good subwoofer, fire it up. It's
might have to
awesome.
Add that to the audio check.
So when Brent looked at how this performed against other subwoofers, he felt that the SHU and the Klipsch models, the R115SW, quote, delivered a more typical, well-rounded subwoofer sound, but didn't sound as tight, as punchy as the Monoprice did, that they were fatter and, quote, in some ways more satisfying, unquote.
The shoes seem like a great deal.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of shoe subwoofers because...
VTF Mark III's are a larger driver, but, you know, $600 more.
Yeah, well, when you look at shoe, right, they've got, you know...
With Monoprice somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, well, they've got, you know, you can have both ports open. You know, you can close one port. You can adjust the Q. You can do a lot of things to tune the shoe subwoofers pretty dramatically. To super tight or super, super sloppy, although I don't think I've ever heard a SHU subwoofer sounding sloppy. They go down incredibly low. You know, Dr. SHU basically has done nothing but build subwoofers for a very long time, and he sells them direct, so they are a fantastic deal. So, you know, off the top of my head, I don't think there's anything wrong with the Monolith subwoofers. They sound like a fantastic deal, and if Brent says they're good, they're good. The dude's heard all the subwoofers and tested more subwoofers than I ever will be able to. Well, what's interesting about the review, so one of the things that defines the SHU subwoofers is they have a pair of ports and they come with plugs. So you can plug the ports to change whether you want for sort of maximum bass in the room or maximum extension, right?
Useful.
You get to choose between those. And you can change the Q settings and the EQ settings. There's a lot of opportunities to make the SHU subwoofers the best possible experience in your room. And I'm a big fan of SHU subwoofers. Like I'm circling between buying another SHU subwoofer or buying a RSL Speedwoofer right now, because at some point when I save up enough pennies, one of those two will be mine.
And two of his three choices are SHUs anyway. So,
yeah, you know, a bigger SHU or a smaller SHU.
The VTF twos or threes.
Yeah, I mean, I would basically be like, do you want to go, which one goes lower? Do you really need to go that low, or does it give you that much more impact? Like, I don't think 2,500 cubic feet sounds that huge.
Square feet or cubic
feet? He said cubic, I'm pretty sure.
It says cubic.
It says cubic. That's not a big room, so I'd probably just go with the smaller ones.
I was thinking that was a square foot for some reason.
Well, the VTF2 Mark V or the VTF3 Mark V, they're both, you know, one's a 12-inch subwoofer, one's a 15-inch subwoofer. They go down pretty much below the threshold of human hearing. What's interesting about Brent's article, it's Soundstage Access, and it's a review of the Monoprice Monolith THX Ultra 15-inch subwoofer, is the word he uses over and over again, that it's very, very tight. It's very, very controlled. And, you know, he starts out with one of his favorite tracks, Nika's Dream, Horace Silver's Horoscope, and he's running out on a 320 kilobits per second Ogg Vorbis Blue Note / Spotify. My conclusion largely summed up my overall impression of the sub. Geez, this thing is tight. No matter how I configure the sub's ports or EQ switch, Gene Taylor's double bass always sounded very clean, very punchy, and well-defined. Even with all three ports open, there was no trace of boom or ringing. And he, you know, went through a whole bunch of musical tests and took a look at U571, which is a fantastic movie for playing around with the low end, right? Because there's depth charges, ship engine rumble, cannon fire. There's a lot going on in that film to give your subwoofer a workout.
I would think if you were going to go with one subwoofer, I would probably go with the larger 15-inch.
Yeah.
As far as shoes products go. But since you're using two of them anyway, I think you have more flexibility in terms of what you want. And if you're leaning towards the VF2s, I do not think that would be overkill.
Yeah.
I think that would just be awesome in many, many ways. And you'll have no lack of bass in that room in a very controlled way without having to push the drivers beyond what they can handle. It should sound absolutely delightful. With a little bit of timing and calibration, it should sound fantastic.
Yeah, I mean... Brent's review basically says that it sounded different. It was very, very tight.
Oh, as far as the Monoprices go?
Yeah, it was very, very precise. It was very, very defined.
Now, did Brent look at the 12-inch one that Tom was interested in or the 15-inch version?
For the Monoprice?
For the Monoprice.
I think he was looking at the 15-inch version.
Okay. See, that's the thing. I'm trying to recall. I simply remember larger subs in terms of driver size, just simply producing a more powerful sound. And it was, to me, more noticeable when there was only one to be dealt with.
Right.
So the fact that you're going with two, I think it just kind of opens up the possibilities. It at least gives you some smaller cabinet sizes to deal with, right, if nothing else, in terms of placement.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'll be honest with you. I'm a huge fan of Shoe.
Yes.
I would automatically lean towards going with Shoe. Not that there's anything wrong with
a pair of 12-inchers.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, so it's THX certified. What does that mean? You're going to get like 115 dB in a 2,000 cubic foot room if you're within like 10 or 12 feet of the subwoofer, right? So
I always hope that just simply implies better linearity in terms of its response and things like that.
Well, it should get really, really loud. It should have very, very low distortion. You know, Brent's point is that it has a very distinctive sound, and it's a very, very tight sound, a very, very controlled sound. And if you want to shake the couch and feel like you're being whacked with depth charges, you may prefer the Shoe sound or the Klipsch sound.
Or if you are planning to make this a music listening scenario only. Then, but when Brett's point about how certain
if I was going to be that uptight, I'd go with like one of the 15-inch ultra subs from Shoe.
There you go.
A sealed subwoofer.
Now we're talking.
Oh, they're pretty badass.
You have some good options.
I think you'll be fine with either of, you know, any of those three subs. You know, I don't think two VTF, two Mark V's is overkill if you set them up correctly. You know, I'm a big fan of what they do at Shoe. I'm a big fan of the tremendous performance they deliver for the money. You know, that said, I've had a lot of good luck with Monoprice over the years. The 8323, that's the $16, you know, over-ear headphone that can do.
Tom, on the other hand, has a very good speaker budget.
Yeah.
Even just for subs. For me, I'm like, let's see, let's start with the $200 mono prices first.
You know, personally, I want the two Shoe subwoofers.
Oh, no.
You know, so I
that would make me smile.
There's only so many ways I can say buy the Shoe, Tom. So
I'm so avoiding speaker purchasing right now because I will just go nuts in terms of what I really want.
There's a really nice pair of...
There's a lot of things.
Emotiva T2s for sale in Los Angeles right now on Craigslist. All it takes is a road trip and a dream.
Oh,
those are nice speakers for the money.
Mm-hmm.
One last thing before we go. You want to talk about $1,500 4K HDR projectors.
Yeah. Person named Matt wrote in asking about, thanking us for our home theater podcast that covers all price ranges and has down-to-earth discussions about tech and standards. Hey, Matt, thank you. He wanted to get our thoughts on reasonably priced 4K DLP projectors. And I'm just going to quote the rest of this email. While they all show 8.3 million pixels on the screen, none of them seem capable of going past SDR color or brightness. Does the 4K resolution matter more on a projector than a TV, where wide color gamut and high brightness are the main selling points? Given the lumen output of these projectors, are they a good alternative to, say, a 75-inch TV in anything but a dark room? Say, maybe a light-filtered living room? ? Thanks, Matt. Yes. All of these value 4K projectors, and I'm going to say pretty much every projector I see under $5,000 4K are doing nowhere near, say, 90% or greater DCI color compared to Rec. 709, the HD color standard. Most of these projectors, even most 4K projectors, are barely doing Rec. 709. Now, that said, there are some amazing values out there in addition to some very good 1080p projectors for even less. One thing I noticed about all of the latest crop of 4K projectors, not all, but a great many of these DLP single chip ones, is that they're abandoning 3D support. Now, one of the exceptions, and pretty much the only exception I found to this, was BenQ's HT2550. And that's if you can find it. I think they stopped shipping these due to, coincidentally, a recent firmware update related to 3D playback. If you have purchased this particular projector, the BenQ HT2550, after March 16th, it should include that update. But if you happen to own that projector and you've never checked its firmware, do give it a look. That said, I will say the folks over at Projector Central are in love with the ViewSonic PX727. It doesn't have lens shift, but it is a terrific value. I want to say it is like $1,200 or $1,300 for a solid 4K experience. And one thing you're going to find also on even I would say any of these projectors we're talking about for the most part, there's no lens shift, which makes setup easier if you plan on mounting one of these and you don't have the room environment to where you can just move that projector until it's in the exact right spot. That said, there are some terrific options out there, and latency may be an issue if you're dealing with gaming scenarios on a projector. So that is a spec to actually pay attention to when you're shopping around. Many projectors actually add quite a bit of latency, even in their quote-unquote game modes. So if Twitch gaming and high-performance response for your game console is critical, be aware of what that latency value is going to be. Now, I will say, in addition to that awesome ViewSonic PX727, a 1080p projector. And by the way, there are terrific 1080p home theater projectors out there starting at about $550. Mm-hmm. That $500 to $900 range for bulb lamp-based 1080p projectors is well saturated with many, many good options. So if you need to save some money, if anything over $1,000 is just way out of the price point for you, I think pointing a 1080p projector, a value 1080p projector at a 100-inch screen is going to look freaking fantastic.
Yeah.
And you can have that complete setup for $800. I mean, screen mounted on the wall with the projector and everything.
Even if you don't have the number of lumens you would like ideally, it's amazing what a decent set of blackout curtains, which you can pick up at IKEA.
Totally.
Or make yourself. It's amazing what throwing up some serious curtains can do for the light performance of a projector.
Or keeping any of the lights in a room from actually having a direct path right to the screen and illuminating that screen with something other than the projector. Now, I did find my favorite LED 1080p projector, the LG PF1500W. This actually uses red, blue, green LEDs, so you get a minimum of 20,000 hours of lamp life. I don't think you can replace the lamp module in this, but you won't ever have to worry about it burning out. And the nice thing about it is the price, I think it hovers around $800, dips a little bit lower than that on sale, and it incorporates really cool stuff too, like ATSC tuner built in, apps in terms of it having built in networking like Wi-Fi and Bluetooth and things like that. And it's just a terrific option overall. So
I picked up my first projector refurbished from Optoma.
Oh yeah.
Gosh, probably almost 10 years ago now. And I've never considered
factory refurbished. I'm comfortable with.
Yeah, it was woot.
Yeah.
And I have not looked back since. I'm running a Epson 1080p projector. I'm holding off for as long as possible before going to 4K.
Our mutual friend Jeffrey Morrison has probably been using a projector as his primary display for the last 15 years. I believe I talked to him about that recently. It is a great way to go. So is 4K the be-all end-all? Well, you're not getting HDR color.
That, to me, is a problem.
And honestly, you're hoping that these projector companies who are not able to produce, amazing contrast at least, are at least optimizing that image quality with HDR sources so they don't look odd when you're displaying them. Or you're not seeing much of a difference between just a plain 4K upgrade versus 4K with peak brightness detail in addition to a wider, more natural looking color palette. So there are terrific options out there. I suddenly want to see this ViewSonic in person just to put eyeballs on it and worship accordingly. So I haven't seen many 5-star reviews out of Projector Central, and that one just hit the charts, and it's like, wow.
That may be the most enthusiastic review I've ever
glowing.
Seen.
Glowing. It really was. It really was.
Oh, goodness. With that, ladies and gentlemen, we mentioned it before. Patreon.com/AVXL is the place to find, us, if you want to support us via Patreon. AVXL.com is the website. We got all of our RSS feeds and links and older shows you can download from. We were talking about Altered Carbon.
Yeah. I finally fired that up and burned through it, and that's my kind of sci-fi. I really dug it. There might have been like one episode I felt was like, toward the middle of that season, but in terms of start to finish, it's really dark, but it's enjoyable sci-fi storytelling. And I got to say, Netflix HDR plus the sound quality, it looks fantastic. It really does. I was watching that peg up to 15.26 megabit or whatever that max was, but that to me was just a neat story. It's, and speaking of Netflix,
pretty, but that may have been one of the most expensive things that Netflix has produced in-house.
It could be. That definitely. And I recently took a trip to see Netflix at their Hollywood studios, and I'll get into that in the next episode. But between that and a quick trip over to the good folks at Technicolor, I got a chance to really look at some of the behind-the-scenes work of these storytellers and how they bring their content to the screen and how everyone is well aware of the differences between SDR and HDR and the focus on providing simplicity in terms of producing this content for two drastically different viewing experiences. Mm-hmm. Your regular TVs, in addition to these new ultra bright, ultra colorful 4K TVs, they are really focused on producing the best content they can.
Seems like it would be a challenge to kind of split that middle.
It was interesting. It's really all trending toward being able to go through one workflow and then have it output the SDR. Do everything in HDR and then have it dump cleanly to SDR. So you're not, doing everything twice. But I'll get into that in terms of what I saw and did in their production facilities. And that was utterly fantastic. Oh, my goodness. They have some nice offices, too. And it constantly... It's
next week.
Yes.
Next week.
It was good.
Well, that, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening to AVXL. As we may have mentioned it, we talk about home theater, we talk about audio, we talk about getting you the best deal. We don't care if you got $1 million or if you got a couple hundred bucks. We can help you have a better experience enjoying your music, your movies, your television, your sports. I don't think we had one MLB.TV reference in this whole show, so I took care of that.
I tried not to. I did bring up 4K streaming about that, but... hey, and I think we have a question related to that next week as well, so...
Tune in next week. AVXL.com is the website, and search for us on all your favorite podcatching and listening tools. I'm Patrick Norton.
Hey, I am Robert Herron.
We'll catch you next week on AVXL.